From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on late Friday night in Moscow, Russia, near the Kremlin. One of the leaders of the opposition to Russian leader Vladimir Putin was walking with his girlfriend. 55-year-old Boris Nemtsov had become a well-known figure challenging Putin about corruption in the Sochi Olympics, and more pressingly, challenging Putin's claims that there are no Russian troops in eastern Ukraine. Friday evening, Nemtsov went on Echo Moscow Radio, saying that he expected the economic crisis to bring swarms of people onto the streets of Moscow in the coming months. He said his own mother was worried that Vladimir Putin would have him killed. He said a big protest demonstration was planned for Sunday, when he would reveal more about Russia's alleged involvement in Ukraine. Nemtsov left the radio station, apparently had dinner with a girlfriend, and was walking along the street. The Kremlin was in full view, and even on this February night, there was no snow to worry about. And then a truck rolled up. Someone fired 7 gunshots. 4 of the shots struck Boris Nemtsov, and he fell dead. His girlfriend was not hurt. In the UK, The Telegraph writes, quote, "Already it seems the cover-up has started. All of the nearby cameras surrounding the crime scene were said to have been conveniently under repair at the time of the murder. When journalists challenged that assertion with photos of dozens of cameras on the walls of the Kremlin, Russian authorities then said the cameras were all pointed in the wrong direction." End quote. But how about a local municipal camera nearby? Would you believe that at that moment of the murder, a large snowplow blocked the camera's view? Remember, there was no snow on the streets that night. Vladimir Putin says he will lead the investigation into the death of an opposition leader. His party has said Nemtsov might have been gunned down by, who knows, Islamic fanatics or even a jealous lover. But how about Putin, or at least ordered by Putin? Well, Putin says that's absurd. As for Sunday's demonstration, it became a memorial march for Boris Nemtsov. Estimated between 15 and 70,000 people marched, but is this the beginning of a stronger challenge to Vladimir Putin, or will this have a chilling effect on criticism? My guest for the hour will help sort out these questions and more. From the University of Rochester, Randy Stone is the director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies. Always good to have you, Randy. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Matthew Leno is a professor of Russian history at the University of Rochester. And, Professor, nice to see you.
Good to be here, Evan.
You also are the author of a number of works that, to me, felt there was a kind of a parallel. You have written about, first of all, your first book, Closer to the Masses, on examine the origins of Stalinist culture, and your newest book, looking at an assassination of the Leningrad Party chief Sergei Kirov in 1934. But you say the events of Friday night, whatever the origins, aren't a perfect parallel to the 1930s.
I'll begin by saying that even if we assume, and it's actually a questionable assumption, that Stalin ordered Kirov's murder and that Putin ordered Nemtsov's murder. Kirov was a member of Stalin's inner circle, so he was clearly, at least on the surface, a member of the ruling elite. And Nemtsov obviously was an oppositionist who had been effectively politically marginalized many years ago. So that alone suggests quite a difference. It would be a difference probably in the way that the assassination would be used. Stalin used it to implicate suspected political enemies, not necessarily real political enemies, within the party. If Putin chooses to use Nemtsov's murder, it basically looks like it would be intimidation against a tiny and marginalized liberal opposition. Now, we can talk later about the question. It's possible Putin is behind the murder. It's also possible there is another plausible scenario. And in my own book on the Kirov murder, I argued that it was a lone gunman who killed Kirov, but Stalin used the murder.
The Guardian in the UK has called this, quote, the highest profile political killing in Russia in a decade. And Randy, again, that sort of indicts without evidence yet. They're calling it a political killing. We don't know that. Is it dangerous to jump to that conclusion, or is it understandable to have that suspicion?
Well, no, I think that this is consistent with Putin's general strategy to have a little bit of plausible deniability, but never too much. Right. So, there have been a number of high-profile killings that have been done in ways that directly point back to the KGB, very deliberately. You can think of the Litvinenko case in London with the exotic radioactive isotope, the poisoning of Yushchenko, right, who was at the time presidential candidate in Ukraine in 2004, was similarly it was an exotic kind of thing. In this case, what's exotic is the location, right? So I would assume that Putin had him shot. I think most people in Russia assume that that's the case, but that we will never know. We'll never know for sure. Of course, I thought that Sergei Kirov had been killed by Stalin, too, until Matt straightened me out. I shouldn't be judge or prosecutor. I don't have a legal background. But I think that he could have been killed anywhere. And if it were not intended to point back at the Kremlin, it would be unlikely to have him shot in such a public place, right? So close to the Kremlin, in the midst of all these cameras, which are, as you say, conveniently turned the wrong direction. That seems to be telegraphing to everyone, no, I didn't do it, but yeah, I really did.
As in, when you say plausible deniability, but not too much, Putin wants the public to know, you will never fully know, but you should always fear?
I think that's right. I don't think that he wants to admit to many things that he has done. This is similar to the case in Crimea, right, where initially the denials were about the use of uniformed Russian troops or ununiformed Russian troops to take over Crimea. And then shortly thereafter, Putin acknowledged, of course we did it. He wants to maintain a plausible deniability up until a point, but he wants everyone to know who's really calling the shots.
I think that a lot of the points Randy has just made arguing for Putin's involvement in the murder are strong points. I think there's another plausible version, which is that Nemtsov was murdered on the orders of ultra-nationalist organizations, for example, the anti-Maidan movement. Extreme Russian nationalists have on the web what are basically hit lists of enemies who are viewed as traitors. These are again, part of the small but, I guess, still vocal liberal opposition. So it's possible that he was shot by one of these groups. It certainly looks like a contract hit, and without the direct involvement of Putin. Now, whether they perceived that this was something Putin wanted is another question. It also raises the possibility that Putin is losing control of these extreme nationalist groups who he has tried to manipulate, for example, with his presentation of the fighting in Ukraine as, for example, genocide against Russians in Ukraine. It's possible he has certainly tried to use them. What is a little scary in terms of fits sort of the German conservative collaboration with Hitler in the early 30s, although there's always a problem with Hitler parallels, but what's scary is the possibility that Putin is losing control of these folks and then he's going to be pressed in a more and more extreme nationalist direction. But again, I don't know which, I'm not saying that that's what happened. I think that Randy also has a strong points here in terms of Putin's direct involvement.
If you want to join the program or have questions or comments for our panel, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Randy, are we overstating Boris Nemtsov's importance in his death now?
Well, everyone looks a little bit more heroic, of course, after such an event. But I think he would have been on anyone's short list for really good presidential candidates for Russia. I mean, if I were pressed to ask, well, who would I like to be the next president of Russia, Boris Nemtsov would have been at the top of my list. He was someone who had extensive government experience, but it was during the Yeltsin era. Mm-hmm. And he had his hands clean during the Putin era, which is not true of a lot of the other Yeltsin era figures who might have been in contention. He's someone who, at least by reputation, has always been very much a straight shooter, fighter against corruption, someone who was very interested in economic reform and promoting it. I never got a chance to meet him. I interviewed a lot of his contemporaries in the Yeltsin government. But my sense is that those who knew him believed him to be the genuine article.
And interesting, because I think Matt Randy makes an important point that in death we often veer towards hagiography, but in this case, as clean a record as I have seen, what do you make of Mr. Nemtsov?
Well, I want to challenge Randy on one point, I guess. Nemtsov was no longer the most important face of the opposition. I think Alex Navalny was. I think that we need to understand that the liberal, in the sense of liberal democratic, market-oriented movement in Russia within the Federation is utterly marginalized. Their parties can't even hit the 5% threshold for getting into the Duma. And I think that most Russians think of these folks as anti-Russian extremists. And as we know, Putin enjoys perhaps somewhat inflated, but arguably very high approval ratings. I think Nemtsov's importance and the reason that he angered people in power was because he produced and got out publicly within Russia reports on corruption, for example, of the massive corruption associated with the construction of the Olympic complex in Sochi. He also, from his native province in Yaroslavl, he produced devastating reports on corruption of the Yaroslavl leadership. Another possible scenario is this was a hit from people within the Yaroslavl leadership. And he was, as you suggested, he was apparently about to come out with a report claiming to prove direct Russian military involvement in Ukraine, which would be unsurprising, but the direct proof.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I have to then wonder if we are not overstating Boris Nemtsov, but the opposition, because as Professor Leneau mentioned, when we in the media talk about Vladimir Putin, opposition, it's almost this sort of false equivalence that we fall into, or maybe that we are trapped into thinking that the Russian public is split or someone has more power than they hold. We saw a demonstration, some reports say 15,000, some said 70. Regardless, we knew there were a lot of people demonstrating on Sunday, but that's in the grand scheme of Russia. It's not a huge number. So I don't know. Does this bolster opposition? Could we see more actual impact on the construct of the Duma going forward, or actual opposition to Putin? Or are we overstating?
So I think that there's a sense in which we're overstating. I mean, there within Moscow there are many dissidents who belong to the professional middle classes and educators. And they have turned out regularly for anti-regime demonstrations in the number of thousands or tens of thousands. We don't see this in the provinces. This is a very small group. I think that this is a group of extremely brave people. I think that they are not going to be intimidated by this murder. I mean, I'm certain that internally they're more frightened, but in the great tradition of Russian dissidents, they will continue to take a stand. I also think that within Russia, they're very, very marginalized. And most of the Russian population sees, for example, a Natalia Talanikova of the dissident punk group Pussy Riot as a freak. And so that's where I would stand.
Yeah, I think we always want to ask, as outsiders who don't study Russia regularly, we always want to ask, well, what do Russians think? And that's obviously a complex question. But when you look at Boris Nemtsov's murder, Randy, you agree with Professor Leneau on that?
Well, I agree that he was not on the verge of starting a major mass movement before he was assassinated, and he was not the most prominent member of the opposition at this point. Though he was always front and center, he was always involved in these major protest movements. For example, in 2011, when for months there were continuous street protests in Moscow, Boris Nemtsov was continuously involved, and he was one of the organizers, certainly not the most important. But Navalny, unfortunately, doesn't have credentials that would make him a credible candidate for a position like president. That doesn't mean that it's impossible for him to. All sorts of things happen in Russia, but. Nemtsov was one of the few who would have looked like a good liberal candidate. That was really the point that I wanted to make. In terms of what the immediate reaction is likely to be, I think that there will be some intimidation. I mean, already the people are speaking as if they're intimidated. Alexei Kudrin, for example, said that, you know, up until this point, leaders of the opposition were afraid of being jailed, put under house arrest. Now we're afraid to walk around the streets of Moscow. But on the other hand, they showed up for the funeral. The issue, though, is that the liberal opposition is marginalized and is concentrated basically in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So in the two historical capitals of Russia. That's because the economy has been very strong. Putin has been very successful, right? And that's all coming to an end, I believe. At least we're at a significant inflection point right now. If oil prices stay low, presumably sanctions will stay in place over a long period of time. Russia's economy is not going to come out of this its current crisis, and it may become quite a bit more serious if things continue in Ukraine to escalate. I can imagine that the situation looks very different, and these end up looking like the kernel of a mass movement again.
I'll question Randy, but I think it's good to have this exchange. Mm-hmm. I think that it's correct that if the economy continues to tank, that Putin is going to have serious problems. I don't think that the liberals would emerge as the viable opposition at that point. I think a coup from within the Putin leadership or one of the parties such as the A Just Russia Party, which more or less colludes with Putin but is a democratic socialist party, that these would emerge more likely as an opposition. And the 1990s economic reform attempts within Russia are viewed very skeptically. They've been widely discredited.
That's definitely true.
Jake wants to know, given the risks associated with it, why would Boris Nemtsov announce he was coming out with a report on Ukraine rather than just quietly release it?
He was a gutsy, courageous man, and he was, I think that he was outraged by what was happening in Russia, and I think some people are morally driven that way. I don't want to necessarily compare him to Martin Luther King, except to say we have our own figures who were willing to risk their lives to speak out on a moral basis.
So I don't know that I'm getting agreement from both of you regarding whether this, we're calling it a murder. I think it certainly is a murder, but call it a hit job if you want. But I don't know if I'm getting agreement regarding whether this will have a chilling or an emboldening effect. Professor Leneau is saying that there is a history of courageous dissent. Randy is noting, Professor Stone is noting that some of the other leading opposition figures have indicated already the possible impact psychologically on this. But I don't know if you agree on what this is going to do going forward, and I also don't know that it matters. And by that, I mean, I don't know if the dissent was ever strong enough to really challenge Putin anyway, but ultimately chilling or emboldening, Professor Stone?
I think that this probably has an ultimately chilling effect, but I don't think that means that opposition won't continue to Putin. And I think that there is potential for that opposition to gather steam and for previously discredited political alternatives to come to the fore when the economy gets bad enough.
I'd like to make a point. I suppose that on the opposition liberal movement, this will have, depending on the individuals, an intimidating or effect, or it will cause them to resist more strongly. As I've said, I think that at least for the foreseeable future, the liberal opposition is marginalized. I do think that there's another question, which is, what does this mean? And as a Russian historian, I ask, what does this mean for Russian history? And the articles, some of the Russian commentary has said this is sort of the final blow to the era of idealism that followed among some Russian intellectuals and educated folks when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that Nemtsov was one of the last spokesmen for this perestroika, post-perestroika idealism. And I think that in the future, based on the Nemtsov murder and on the incursions into Ukraine, that this may, 2014-15, may be viewed as a breakpoint in Russian history, the end of an era that began with perestroika.
Professor Stone, agree, disagree?
That's very interesting. I mean, he was mentioned again, I think, in today's New York Times. One of the prominent Russian novelists said he was the last optimist, right? Which is right in line with what Matt was saying. I guess my sense is that Russians have historically lifted up people who they saw were martyred, and have drawn sort of spiritual strength from their example. And so there, I guess, since Andrei Sakharov maybe is an example, although he wasn't martyred, but he was a long-term political prisoner in the Soviet Union and became a very powerful force in Russian politics, his memory. And I can imagine something like that eventually developing out of the example of Boris Nemtsov. It's quite possible. It's the kind of thing that happens in Russian political culture.
It's worth noting that Nemtsov's funeral was held at the Sakharov Center mm-hmm. in Moscow.
Let me get to the phones, and I see them starting to ring. This is Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, how are you? Evan, starting about 15 years ago, I and several other lawyers and judges in Rochester developed a program, an exchange program of lawyers and judges in Rochester and lawyers and judges in our sister city of Novgorod. And that program went on. It started under Clinton. It was continued under Bush. We were part of an umbrella group that had similar exchange programs between sister cities across the U.S. and across Russia. There came a point in time, and this was about 7 or 8 years ago, where Putin issued an edict that essentially said, if you, Russian citizen, are working with any not-for-profits, foreign not-for-profits, you run the risk of being considered disloyal. And these relationships that we had developed, I mean, personal relationships, personal and professional relationships with these lawyers and judges, who many of them came to Rochester on a couple of occasions, many of us went over to Novgorod on several occasions, personal relationships instantly evaporated. So I think that there's little question that these kinds of actions, whether they're official edicts that are handed down to the various regions or something as brutal as the murder of Nemtsov, have an effect and a serious killing effect. And I just view this as just one more step, maybe the final step along that line. Just wanted to provide that comment.
Yeah, Chris, thank you for the phone call. You're getting nods in the studio from our panel. Professor Stone, what do you make of that?
Well, Chris, I'd just like to applaud you for the work that you did all those years. And I think that those sorts of person-to-person contacts were the best hope for developing an organic and sort of strong support for what we think of as the tradition of rule of law in the United States, in Russia as well. Unfortunately, as you say, that was very threatening to the new regime that Putin constructed. And he went so far as to say that anyone who received funds from foreign NGOs or foundations had to register as an agent, a foreign agent, which in Russian parlance sounds like you're signing yourself up as an enemy of the people. So this had a very chilling effect, not just on these kinds of exchanges, but also on all the sorts of foreign aid before it was outlawed entirely in Russia the United States and other countries were providing to the informal sector in Russia. These sorts of activities are threatening to an authoritarian regime, and that's why he took action against them.
Again, also, Chris, I think that was great work you were doing. I think that the measures against NGOs were a very important part and are a very important part of Putin's offensive, of his attempt to create a more authoritarian regime. Putin's strategy has been to engage in quasi-legal harassment of the opposition. For example, one has to get to hold a legal demonstration, one has to get a police permit now, this kind of thing. Effective measures, but maintaining a sort of quasi-legality. The measures against NGOs did, of course, intimidate many Russians who were involved in exchanges with the West. again, I want to differentiate between a much larger group of Russians who, including at the provincial level, were involved in these exchanges and who were intimidated for understandable reasons. I'm sure in their place I would have been intimidated. And a smaller group of the Moscow and St. Petersburg intelligentsia who are still willing to fight. But again, who I think are largely, in one sense, irrelevant, although morally very powerful examples.
Let me get back to the phones, and this is Roy in Rochester. Go ahead, Roy.
Good morning. Sorry, I missed the very beginning of it, but a question to the panel. I'm sorry, I'm still trying to formulate it. It's my first cup of coffee.
It's okay, it's okay.
About Russian history, I'm thinking we're talking both Russian history and current events. And if I wanted to look more thoughtfully at this in a written way, perhaps, Americans have had a number of interpretations about Russia. When we study there, I remember I heard Donald Treadgold explain the division of the peasantry to me when I was a student. It was a great lecture. Or Edward Hallett Carr wants to explain Bolshevism. Robert Conquest explains the Great Tear. Today, what could I go to either in current events or history to look at what's happening?
It's a good question, Roy. Professor Stone, can you weigh in on that?
Well, let's see. In political science, we're always scrambling to figure out what's happened in the recent past, and so our concepts don't always relate very well to immediate current events. But there is a lot of research that's been done on Russian public opinion, for example. I'm thinking of Tim Colton's work on using really extraordinary series of public opinion polls, which are very enlightening about what Russians really think. They defy a lot of facile stereotypes. Russians are really very sophisticated politically. It seems that part of the reason that they don't have strong identification for political parties, particular parties, is that the political parties don't last very long and don't mean very much, right? So sometimes we seem to be putting the cart before the horse in our explanations. It's not necessarily the incompetence of the Russian voter that prevented the Russian political system from stabilizing as a effective democratic system so much as the incompetence of the Russian political elites.
Professor Leneau?
I think that for current events and for recent history, two good online resources would be the Moscow News, which would present a more Western, if you want to call it that, view. And it is useful to read www.rt.com, which is indirectly run by the official Russian news agency and is English language. And interestingly, they're providing almost no coverage of the Nemtsov murder. Indeed, the government media outlets are basically not covering it.
Is that Russia Today?
RT? I think it's called. Right. I'm not sure actually what RT stands for.
Okay, from what I saw, they covered it in a way that almost excluded entirely his biography as a dissenter.
That's correct.
Or just he was well liked and almost left out an entire half from what
yes.
I could see.
Yes, and other Russian. I mean, I would guess that this is because that's aimed at a Western audience. They had to say something. The Russian language outlets, for example, the Communist Party, which is not officially Putin's party, United Russia is, and other government outlets simply aren't covering it in the Russian language outlets. I think that for reading for recent history, Michael McFaul, anything by McFaul, I believe it's spelled M-C-F-A-U-L, Stephen Kotkin's book, Armageddon Averted on the Collapse of the Soviet Union, is useful. And I'm actually, I ought to be able to do this, but I'm struggling for a good sort of survey history of the Soviet Union's collapse. It's a little bit heavy, but Jeffrey Hosking's work, Hosking, might be good.
Mm-hmm. Professor Stone. Go ahead, Professor Stone.
Just another survey of Russian politics that would be useful to cover, to bring you up to date, is Tom Remington's book.
Okay. And Professor Leno?
I just wanted to say that as we look at the rise of Putin's authoritarianism, we need to look at it not as the Soviet Union redux or Stalin redux. I think it's a new form of authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. And I want to squeeze in one more quick comment before we go to break, because it builds on something that Professor Stone mentioned. Randy, you mentioned trying to understand the view on the Russian street, and it's more sophisticated than perhaps we want to. We always want to distill it into, how can the people tolerate this? Well, here Bill writes to the program and says, thanks for hosting this discussion. I firmly believe that if something like this happened, and he's referring again to the murder on Friday night of Boris Nemtsov, a Russian opposition leader. Bill writes, I firmly believe that if something like this happened in the United States, even if the party I support carried out the hit, I and millions of Americans would rightly denounce our leaders as thugs. Why aren't the Russian people doing the same? It's kind of reductive. I think the Bill's question is reflected by what a lot of people are saying. And Randy, how would you answer his question?
Well, I think that is the response of those who are aware of what happened, and that the outpouring of people who are willing to go right out on the Moscow streets again on Sunday is evidence that there's a broad-based sense in Russia that this is not the way things should be done in our country, that this is illegitimate. I think that there was a broad and sort of almost unchallenged sort of assumption that the government must be behind this. There is, I think, there's a lot of sophistication and a lot of outrage. How long this will last among all the other concerns that Russians have, whether it will turn into a political movement, that's another matter. And whether something like this whether an assassination in this country would immediately turn into a political movement, I think is also a question.
Yeah, I think perhaps Bill would say, Professor Leno, well, sure, it's all well and good that in the 48 hours after Nemtsov's murder that there was some outrage. Bill seems to be implying that it would be untenable here, that no political leader could survive taking out their opposition that way. They would be forced from office. There would be some kind of, and that, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I also don't see any change coming in Russia. I'm trying to get my head around what the murder of Boris Nemtsov means, and even if it means sort of a pivot point for Russia to some degree, it doesn't mean Vladimir Putin's going anywhere.
A couple of comments. First, you know, I think one of the things that's frustrating for me about the way people think about Russia is simply that it enables Americans to be very self-satisfied, and that's without saying that anything Putin is doing is justified. I mean, the United States imprisons more people than Russia, China, and Brazil combined. That's not a well-understood fact. I think that there would be outrage if a murder like this happened. I think that the language in which some extreme sectors of the American right-wing movement speak about liberals is eliminationist, and there have been some fringe characters who have, in fact, done things like attacked Unitarian churches. You know, the guy who shot Kirsten Gillibrand was a fanatic right-wing. However, the Republican Party leaders certainly spoke out strongly against this. So I don't want to say Americans would speak out more strongly, certainly. But I'm not sure it's as simple as saying, well, there would be universal outrage. I would also like to note that, yes, I agree that just because this event has happened doesn't mean Putin is going anywhere. In the same way that the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine, which people thought this goes too far, didn't really change anything.
You meant Gabrielle Giffords.
Not Kirsten Gabrielle Giffords. Yes.
Boy.
I was going to say the same.
I'm suffering from serious cognitive decline these days. Thank you.
Some of our audience was wondering if something had happened to Senator Gillibrand. No. That they haven't. But yes, Gabrielle Giffords was the point that Professor Leneau was making. But so before I get our 60-second break-in, and then we'll get back to the phones, Randy, you agree at the very least, Putin goes nowhere. This is not the tipping point event that some people immediately were theorizing that, well, this cannot stand.
No, absolutely not. I think that the most likely scenario for Putin leaving office has to do with his decline in public support, increased street protests and so forth, which then triggers someone within the regime to decide that he's now more a liability than an asset. And we don't know exactly how the power relationships work within the FSB, the successor agency to the KGB, which essentially runs the Russian government. We assume that Putin controls it pretty thoroughly, but no dictator has absolute control. And at some point, if he becomes sufficiently unpopular, then he would be removed by his allies.
844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Your phone calls after the 60-second break. Coming up in our second hour, we get an update on the Supreme Court's hearing of the ACA challenge. We'll talk to Michelle Faust, who's been covering this issue. She'll tell us how it could impact Obamacare in New York State. And then we'll hear about the silent leader, Dr. Freddie Thomas, who arrived in Rochester in 1952 and should probably be mentioned more often as some of the most important figures in Rochester history. Join us next hour.
Donations to the Clinton Foundation help it provide much-needed aid around the world. Some say that donations from foreign governments provide them with much-wanted access to Hillary Clinton.
The foundation, in this case, has been particularly forthcoming about who the donors are, but that doesn't wash away the question of influence and power.
That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's 844-295-TALK, talking about the murder of Boris Nemtsov, one of the leading opposition figures in Russia. He was shot dead on the streets of Moscow inside of the Kremlin late Friday night, just a couple days before another protest was planned, and he had promised to release more information that he said he had collected regarding the presence of Russian troops in eastern Ukraine. And we're talking to a couple of gentlemen from the University of Rochester. It's a chorus of professors from the University of Rochester. Our baritone is Matthew Leneau, who is an author of Russian history and a professor of Russian history. And the tenor is Randy Stone, the director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies. And you actually do perform, yes? You are a tenor, aren't you?
Well, I sing in my church choir, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make clear. And whether or not you do, you could, Professor Leneau.
I can't carry a tune.
We'll work on that. We're talking about what happens in Russia and what happens going forward with the death of Boris Nemtsov. And let's talk a little bit about Ukraine now, and that's been on many people's minds in recent days. We had the folks from with Ukrainian roots in Rochester, Rock Euromaidan, on this program recently, and they are advocating more intervention, more support, billions of dollars, and support in terms of arms and weaponry from the United States, from allies to help the Ukrainians. I had some listeners call the program later that day after the show was over saying, I understand their position, but aren't they advocating for more war? Aren't we walking into more war? Isn't that what Vladimir Putin really wants here? And I'm certainly not the one qualified to answer that, but let me ask our panel. I understand the discomfort some people have with that, with offering arms and assistance. I also understand what Rock Euromaidan and our own community feels when it comes to saying you cannot let that community wither and die without a fight, and that they suspect Vladimir Putin is leading those incursions, whether explicitly or not. Randy, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. Putin is behind all these military ups and downs in Ukraine, and his soldiers are doing the majority of the fighting on behalf of the breakaway portions of eastern Ukraine. The U.S. government has no doubt about that and has made it very clear that that there's no question about that. So then the question is, well, what should we do about it? I guess I don't see any way in which escalating the conflict serves any useful purpose from the point of view of the United States or its allies or the Ukrainians. I'm afraid that the more this becomes an East-West struggle, the worse it will be for Ukraine and the more it will escalate. As Putin is not going to back down short of getting whatever it is that he wants. And what he wants may evolve over time if the stakes become raised. So at present, it seems that he's willing to be satisfied with letting eastern Ukraine be a festering sore, which he can poke at whenever Ukraine is too resistant to his overtures or his objectives, and using that as a way of exerting leverage over Ukraine.
So you expect there to be an ebb and flow in the activity in eastern Ukraine and, I guess, in Donetsk, and that will continue over time based on what Mr. Putin views as favorable to his situation?
I think so. And I think that probably the best that we can hope for is that it becomes one of these frozen conflicts, which, like the Transnistria region in Moldova, or like Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, where this is simply a region of Ukraine that the Ukrainian government can't access, cannot exert a sovereignty over, in which Russia can manipulate when it wants to in order to make lives difficult in Kiev, but that Putin is satisfied with that and then doesn't go further.
Before I kick it back to Matt, the language you're using about the way Putin would sort of exert control in eastern Ukraine is similar to what we talked about a year ago with what for many years he did with Crimea. And the difference is he actually decided not to use the leverage to push and pull, but to finally annex and to take it. Mm-hmm. And should we assume that he wouldn't do the same in eastern Ukraine?
Well, I mean, I predicted that he would not take Crimea. So, I don't claim to have the answers here. But
you're hardly the only one who predicted that, by the way.
but I think that taking Crimea made a certain kind of historical and geographical sense that taking a swath of eastern Ukraine doesn't make. All right, so Crimea is geographically isolated. It's majority Russian ethnic and Russian speaking. Overwhelmingly. And the people in Crimea, for the most part, welcomed becoming part of the Russian Federation. So it had an anomalous historical relationship to Ukraine because it was gifted to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev and had previously been part of the Russian Federation. So many Russians and have felt since even before the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that it logically belonged with the Russian Federation. And so that made sense as a discrete bite to take. There aren't any discrete bites in eastern Ukraine. The whole region it contains majority Russian-speaking, not a majority Russian-ethnic. There's no obvious boundary. It's not obvious where you would stop. And it's a very poor region. Ukraine, before the crisis, Ukraine had about one-third the GDP per capita of Russia. And this is a very poor region full of antiquated industrial enterprises and coal mines that need heavy subsidies in order to continue operating at all. So this is a region that would be an economic drain on Russia, and not particularly attractive. So why would he take it? I guess I don't see a compelling interest to do that.
I agree with just about all of what Randy has said, maybe except the last part, but the most important things. I think that Putin is clearly behind what happened in Korea and what's happening in eastern Ukraine. I think that the question of whether to supply weapons to the Ukrainians is an extraordinarily difficult question. One hates to see this kind of aggression going, I guess, in this case, without military opposition. You know, one of the problems Ukrainians are having is that they don't have anti-tank weapons that are effective against the reactive armor of Russian tanks. I have to agree with Randy, though, that it's hard to see what military aid, how this would improve the situation either for the Ukrainian government or the United, or for the interests of the United States and Western Europe. I think that the fact of the matter is that neither the United States nor Western Europe has the ability to project power into this region that Russia has, so that an all-out military conflict would end badly. And it would also lead to an escalation. My sense, I believe that Russia's goals in the region are limited. If you look at Russian defense white papers, they have to do with maintaining influence in what the Russians call the near abroad, that is, the former Soviet republics. They're not talking about projecting power worldwide, and they're not talking necessarily about direct takeovers of these republics. They're talking about projecting influence. So I think Randy's right. Eastern Ukraine is something Putin can poke at. I think that the goal is probably a frozen conflict, as Randy said, such as is in Abkhazia and Transdniestria.
But Alex writes to the program, essentially he's asking if it's an economic drain on, would be an economic drain on Russia, isn't it an economic drain on Ukraine? Why is Ukraine fighting to keep eastern Ukraine?
Actually, Crimea will also be an economic drain on Russia. It's been estimated that Crimea would perhaps require 5% of the Russian GNP to subsidize. So I think that a genuine sense of nationalism is driving the Russian actions, as well as a sense after the Maidan movement, a Russian perception that they had lost control, what control they had over the situation in Ukraine. I could go into that. I've spoken for a year about Russian perceptions of the situation and how we need to understand them. But at this point, this is naked aggression. So I'm not interested in going into that right now. So I think we're talking about nationalist motives. And also, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, that the Donbas region is majority ethnic Russian, but it's hard to draw the lines between Ukrainians and Russians in this area.
It's not as overwhelmingly ethnic Russian as Crimea was. There's an important distinction there. And there are substantial numbers of ethnic Russians, but it's also a mixed population. And the cities are mostly ethnic Russian, and then the rural areas are more Ukrainian. So it's, again...
Agreed.
It's complicated. It's complicated and messy in eastern Ukraine.
We got a couple minutes left with Professor Stone and Leno, and so let's try to wrap this conversation as we try to look ahead a little bit. Following the murder of Boris Nemtsov, a leading Russian opposition figure on the streets of Moscow this past Friday night, Vladimir Putin says he'll lead the investigation. Our professors have said that essentially we can expect no real conclusion or nothing that's really verifiable. And even if we suspect Mr. Putin was behind it or ordered it or knew of it or benefited from it, we're not likely to unfortunately see any really substantiated evidence of that. But what about the opposition movement going forward? Are there leaders to replace Boris Nemtsov or others who will at least help provide a voice for dissent? Yes?
They exist. I don't think that they're particularly inspiring. I don't find Navalny particularly inspiring. I'm not quite sure what he stands for. I've met some of the opposition leaders, and they didn't strike me as particularly serious, kind of dilettantes at opposition politics. But opposition tends to produce leaders. So if it becomes a broad-based movement, as the economy declines and it becomes clearer to the population that Putin's adventure in Ukraine is not turning out well, I think there's potential for Russian society to generate leadership. That's a highly educated, very impressive society. They'll find some. I think so far they haven't found them.
25 seconds, Matthew, go ahead.
As I've emphasized throughout this, I think there are, throughout this talk, there are many different potential forms of opposition. The polling and electoral results indicates that the Liberal Democratic opposition is extremely small, that real opposition is likely to come from nationalist, statist, welfare state-oriented parties.
Well, we've learned a lot from both of you this hour, and I want to thank you for your time and responding so quickly to the events of this past Friday night that certainly shocked many of us, and we will continue to consult with you going forward, Professors Matthew Leneau, Randy Stone from the University of Rochester. Thanks for your time, Randy.
Thank you, Evan.
Matthew, always good to talk to you.
Thanks.
All right, short break. Talking about the ACA and the challenge of the Supreme Court immediately next right here on Connection. Stay with us.